Wasn't that a great movie? I could see it in my mind. I could hear it in my mind, and it was beautiful. It was funny. It probably didn't even fit with what we were doing anyway, so it doesn't matter. The point of the movie, I can tell you, was about conflicts and the fact that sometimes we don't see eye to eye as to how to resolve a conflict. And so that was to set the tone to let you know that we're going to be talking about conflicts a little bit today in our teaching, in our study. Because conflicts happen anytime you're going to get human beings together. And in my experience, the church is full of human beings. So conflict is something that seems to be inevitable when it comes to church and church community. We're studying the Gospel of Matthew, and if you'd like to follow along with me today in our study, you can head over to Matthew chapter 18, please. Last week, as we began the chapter, Jesus, if you remember, was settling a dispute between the disciples who were trying to figure out which of them was the greatest disciple. Everybody was vying for, you know, the trophy, number one disciple or whatever. So Jesus brought a child into the midst of them, and he taught them a lesson about intentional humility, that greatness in God's economy looks different from our normal assumptions of what constitutes greatness. Greatness, Jesus was letting us know, is revealed in a willingness to take the lowest place, something that's the complete opposite of what the world assumes. The greatness is found in people willing to be non-intimidating, even vulnerable within a community. But then, if you remember, Jesus dealt then with some stern warnings about being careful not to take advantage of those who take that course in life, who do choose to be humble, who choose to be even in a position of vulnerability. And so we looked at our calling as a church to look after each other and to value each other, not to use each other for our own ambitions like the world does so often. That's usually the way things are working, that dog-eat-dog world concept. So our calling is the church, and we were talking about this last week, and we will be filling in some more of those details this week. Our calling as the church is to be an anomaly on the social landscape. We're not supposed to look like or behave like the way the patterns of this world so often dictate. We're not supposed to be just another organization that needs members and money to keep its function. We're supposed to be a community under God's rule. That's what the church is intended to be, a familial gathering, a gathering of people who see themselves as family, where unity and commitment isn't the product of coercion or a sense of obligation, but it's a shared sense of purpose, of learning how to love this amazing God who's revealed himself to us through Jesus, and then learning how to love our fellow human being. And that's a big task. That's not an easy thing. We can say it very easily. It's another thing to experience it. But it sounds, when we describe that purpose, it sounds wonderful, doesn't it? I mean, that idea, it's simplistic and it's beautiful and it's ideology. To me, it was a profound realization when I discovered that the church was meant to be community. And there's two things that I have discovered over the last 20 plus years about community. The first thing is everybody wants it. I mean, everybody wants it. And it's even become a catchphrase in a lot of ways. It's a very popular thing to say. We're aspiring to community. But the second thing that I learned was that it is way harder to pull off than anyone ever suspects. It's way harder than I ever thought it was going to be. Community becomes one of those feel-good kind of words that we tend to idealize a lot in our minds and our thinkings. We kind of come up with our own agendas as to what community is. We oftentimes are thinking of a TV show, you know, where everyone knows your name and you're never lonely and you even have your own theme song that goes with it. That's what we're looking for in community. But reality is very different from that. I mean, I've discovered it's very different. The reality is that community is very difficult to pull off, to carry out. And you know why? Because people, yeah. I've said so many times, church would be so simple if there were no people involved. And why is that? Because you're not me. And that's been the problem all along here. If everyone would just be me, then everything would go very nicely. But you insist on being you, and that's where everything falls apart. Because you don't say things the way that I would say them, and you have different tastes and perspective and life experiences that inform your personality, and so you're different from me that way, and that just makes everything much more difficult. If you were just me, we would understand each other, and we would all get along very nicely. It's very quiet in here. I don't need to explain I'm being facetious, right? You're making me nervous now. You get what I'm saying. I'm making a point, right? This is our problem. This is our problem as the human race, why this becomes a difficult thing. Jesus says, hey, I'm going to call you guys to form a community. There you go. Have at it. It's kind of like throwing people into the deep end of the pool to teach them how to swim. We have we've got a bunch of saved sinners who don't do this Christian thing very well, trying to pull off this concept of community set to this task. So conflict is bound to happen. I mean, that's just a reality we have to understand. Conflict is part of it. Sometimes people will be offended at that notion, or people outside of the church will say, if conflict in the church, well, see, that's the whole problem. I've just said all along, the church is full of hypocrites, to which I normally say, it's not full. We got plenty of room. Come on in. There's room for one more. Conflict is bound to happen. Jesus seems to anticipate that conflict is going to happen, and so he instructs us here. He gives us some more instructions concerning the church community and how we interact with each other socially in the section that we're going to be reading today. So if you're there in Matthew chapter 18, we're going to pick up where we left off, starting with verse 15. Jesus is still talking. He's telling us how it is that we conduct our social interactions with each other. And in verse 15, he says, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him or her their fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you've gained your brother. But if he doesn't listen, take one or two others along with you, that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. If he refuses to listen to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Truly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Again, I say to you, if two of you agree on earth about anything they ask, it'll be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am among them. All right. The whole context of this, we got to keep firmly in mind, is the idea of community, of this corporate interaction, protecting the vulnerable within the community, removing obstacles that would keep people from being able to progress forward in God's plan for their life. So clearly what Jesus has in view here is a conflict between people in the church that can affect the well-being and the unity of the church. This is the idea. So we know how that goes. Man, there are just so many stories all through church history. Probably stories here in this group of people's experiences, how churches have been torn apart because some feud breaks out between a few members and it turns into something where everybody's taking sides and it all just turns into a war. So Jesus starts off his hypothetical by reminding us of the familial nature of this community, because he starts it off saying, if your brother or your sister, we could word it that way too, your spiritual sibling, if that person offends you, sins against you in some way, and that's the idea, offends you. And so he's reminding us that the familial community is what his focus is, and his instructions aren't intended to show us how to get justice or reparations. That's not what his focus is here. It's how to protect the community in a time of conflict. That's what his point is. And what he tells us is that if we're going to do this, then we need to deal with conflict in the community through personal communication and divine discernment. Personal communication and divine discernment. Jesus doesn't give us really a step-by-step guide. People have read it that way, but it's more of a framework here that has as its theme communication, interacting with one another, talking to each other. And Jesus makes it so simple here. Did that just go backwards on me? I don't know what's happening. I'm going to let you guys kind of figure that one out back there. We have got a day of technical fun that's been going on. Anyway, so Jesus makes it very simple in this, that, you know, these things are happening. There's a dispute that's arising. Then go to the person and talk about it. So many conflicts that arise, whether we're talking about in the church community or in any framework, could be resolved through personal communication, through interacting, through talking and discussing this thing. Yeah, but you know, I don't want to talk to that person. She hurt me. I'd rather talk about that person to everybody else so that everybody else sees that I'm right and that person is awful. That's just the worst. And that is the easier thing to do. It really is. It's much simpler to talk to everybody else about the other person. And to be honest, if we're going to be fully honest about that, there's a perverse sort of pleasure associated with that as well. But it will not resolve anything. It actually just makes the community that much worse. So Jesus says, go to the person and talk it out. Tell the person what the grievance is. Tell the person your perspective on what's happening there and find out their perspective and see if you're perceiving things the same way. I would say half the time that there are conflicts or issues like that, it comes down to miscommunication, a misunderstanding between people. That's such an important component of any sort of conflict resolution, and it's true on any level, whether we're talking about in the church community or at the workplace or even in our own homes with our spouses or our families. Communicate about the conflict. Give it name and allow room for discussion. And in humility, as he described earlier, be willing to listen to each other. Discussion is a fast eroding art form in our culture right now. We don't discuss. We shout past each other and firmly ensconced in our perspectives and points of views. And there's no more obvious vehicle for that than on the political landscape or on some of these news programs and things like that. But to be able to discuss, to hear, to listen to the different perspectives. And why is this important? Because when we don't hear the other person, when we don't allow the other person to be able to provide for us the information about what's happening, our imagination begins to fill in all the unknowns. Our imagination at that point takes over as to what's going on here. And we begin constructing a straw man about what the motives are. So we've got this caricature. We've got this straw man of what motives and intents there are in place of the person. Our minds start, you know, why did he turn away and not acknowledge me when I saw him at the store? Is he mad at me? Is he purposely being rude to send the message that he doesn't like me? Does he not want to talk to me because he thinks I'm not smart enough? Is that why they turn away and try to avoid me? They don't like me. They think I'm a social pariah. And before long, we've imagined enough foul motive that we've created this image of a horrible person who's out there. And somebody says, well, why don't you go talk to him? I don't want to talk to that person. He's a monster. Have you heard some of the things I've imagined him saying? It's terrible. We run the danger, and here's the thing, we run the danger of reacting and responding to an imagined person rather than the person who's really there, really in front of us. That's why it's so important. That's why Jesus' first step in this, go talk it out. He wants to nip that in the bud. Go talk with them, not at them, not even necessarily to them, although there's sort of an element, but mostly it's with them. Discuss this thing. And if that doesn't resolve things, he says, well, then get a few other people involved. Have somebody come and observe what's happening here. The whole community. I almost get this sense of, it's almost like, you know, get as many involved in this as you need to find resolution if we can't resolve things peacefully. And it's important to notice here that this is not getting the community together as witnesses against someone in the wrong. That's not even how Jesus describes this. It's as witnesses to the interaction. Have people come and look at this and observe the exchange, because it could just be the person with the complaint is the person in the wrong. You need a few more objective eyes and ears on the situation to know what's happening here. And again, you know, Jesus uses this phrase that links the activity of the church with the activities of heaven, saying that, you know, what you bind here on earth is bound in heaven. In other words, this is, you know, a yes here is a yes in heaven. What you say and how you treat each other is bigger than you realize. It's bigger than just this stuff of earth. All of heaven is interacting and involved in this whole thing. The stakes are high, but the ability to discern well is assured because Jesus also reminds us that he is present in that gathering of people, regardless of how many it is that are coming together to resolve this conflict. The ability to discern is there because Jesus is there in that. In In fact, that's why the community of faith is so important, because gatherings like this one where we are today and the ones all around the world is where Jesus promises to be present in this earth. That's the importance of our gathering. Jesus is present in the church, in us and with us as we gather together, as we're here doing this act of worship. This makes the gathering of the church a unique place. It makes us unique in all the world. But that's why it's so vital to do this hard work of resolving conflict and appealing for divine discernment for it, because community is a fragile thing. It's something that needs to be cared for and looked after and treated carefully. Because the whole idea is to preserve the unity of the church. That's what his theme is in this. To the point that if someone is contrarian, this is what he's getting at in this. If someone is contrarian, refuses to cooperate towards peace, or just, you know, adamant about covering up some wrong or whatever, it may be necessary, he says, to part ways. I would, you know, we would assume that that would be a rare thing, but he allows for the possibility of that. It could just be that there has to be a separation there. Now, when he makes this phrase about, treat them like Gentiles and tax collectors, the first century Jewish listeners knew that that meant that they were going to pursue a formation of community faith without that person's influence or input. In other words, in the local synagogues there among the Jewish people, it was not the tax collectors and the Gentiles who were directing affairs of the synagogue or helping to form their formation of their community. That was, you know, this was, they were outside of that in that sense. So that's basically what he's saying, is that if this contrarian attitude is there, or this persistence in sin in some way that's disruptive to the community, is going to require a separation to where that influence is not there in the formation of community. We know from Jesus's own example that he cannot mean to shun somebody or to be disrespectful to somebody or something like that when he's saying, because how did Jesus treat tax collectors and Gentiles? I mean, he was all about showing kindness and humanizing people. I like how Eugene Peterson words this in The Message. It says, if he won't listen to the church, you'll have to start over from scratch. Confront him with the need for repentance and offer again God's forgiving love. So that's a good way to understand it. It doesn't mean we ever shun or dehumanize. We just have to realize there's an impasse here of direction and intent. And it can all be handled lovingly and graciously without harming a soul in that. You get that? You see what we're saying in that? So the whole point is for the preservation of the community. Because as we've said multiple times here, real community is a difficult thing. It can be fragile, and it's so worth preserving. Why? Because we're two or more are gathered. And granted, you know, this is one of those, where two or more are gathered in my name is usually used by preachers who are feeling bad that there aren't many people at his service. And so he likes to throw that out there. But the context here is dealing with conflict resolution, but the principle behind it actually is quite profound. The realization that this gathering, you look around this place, this is where Jesus is manifest. This is where he's present in this world. That's important stuff. We're here in the presence of heaven. That's an important thing to keep intact. Okay, so I can imagine that there's some silence in the group as Jesus makes these statements. They're puzzling it all through. And a thought suddenly occurs to Peter. And so we get to verse 21. It says, then Peter came up and said to him, Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times? And Jesus said to him, I don't say to you seven times, but 70 times seven. Okay, again, keeping the context in mind, that of community, Peter starts thinking through what this is going to look like in the details. He's trying to, you know, consider all the ramifications of this. And so he asks a pretty straightforward question, and what seems to be a reasonable question as we look at it, how often do we forgive an offender in a conflict? Someone who's committing an offense and maybe committing this offense over and over again, how often do I do this? There was a rabbinical teaching at that time that indicated that a person should be extended forgiveness from the synagogue up to three times for the same offense, but after that they were to be cut off from the group. So it could be, and we don't know, but it could be that Peter's got that in his mind and he's thinking, you know, but Jesus has always been a little bit more, you know, intense on the holiness thing. So let me Let me double that number and actually add one more on for good measure. So that gets me up to 7. And hey, that's the number of perfection in the Bible. And so he goes to Jesus and he says, how many? You know, should I do this 7 times? You know, 7 times, that's a pretty holy number of times, isn't it, Jesus? And Jesus, much to my chagrin, responds with a little bit of a math problem. He says, no, 70 times 7. And so Peter, you know, gets his phone out, opens a calculator, and is working through. But see, obviously, the number is not what Jesus' point is. He's trying to describe the absurdity of putting a numerical parameter on forgiveness. The phrase 70 times 7 is something we actually have to think about a little bit. It seems to be an Eastern idiom. In Genesis 4, 23 and 24, the son of Cain, Lamech in Genesis there, sings a song to his wives about how if Cain was avenged 7 times, well, then he's going to get even with people 70 times 7 if they come after him or try to harm him in some way. So he's trying to assert his dominance in this world. And so it's a phrase that's describing a disproportionate response. And this is what Jesus is saying to Peter. It's the idea of a disproportionate response to something, but he's going the opposite side of it than what Lamech did. Jesus isn't telling Peter in this, you know, we put this number out there. We can't imagine that he's telling Peter, you know, get a ledger and keep track of what's happening here and start counting along, you know, how many times you have to forgive this person. And when they get to 491, then that's it. You just take them out because that's it. Peter tried to put a number on forgiveness like he was setting up a contractual arrangement. Like he was establishing parameters for when not to and when to forgive. But forgiveness doesn't work like that. And that's what Jesus is trying to get across. Forgiveness is an attitude of the heart. It's a frame of mind in how we're interacting with our fellow human being. We would get the absurdity of what it is that Peter's saying if Peter had come up and said, Jesus, how many times must I love my neighbor as myself? Up to 7 times? We would see how absurd it is that you put a numerical parameter on that. This is a state of heart, a state of mind. And remember, again, I got to keep bringing it back to this. Community is the larger context, dealing with conflict in the community. And so here we realize that conflict in the community, it's essential that it's guided by a willingness to forgive, a willingness on our part to forgive one another. He's describing here in this is a love for each other that's not keeping score, that refuses to keep score or keep count. Now, here's the thing, and this is where we got to take just a minute of time to discuss this concept, because we throw a word like forgiveness around, and it's so huge. I mean, forgiveness is a huge word with a lot of implication and nuances in it. What does it mean to forgive? When we're talking about this, what are we talking about when we say to forgive one another? And that's a struggle, I would say, for most of us, because language is difficult and it's very, we have a tenuous grasp on how these things work when we're living them out in our own experiences. And sometimes I think we misunderstand the concept of forgiveness, and based just on conversations that I have with people. So let me clarify the concept just a little bit. When we're talking about forgiveness and we're using a term like this that is quite heavy, because sometimes we think, and sometimes I'll even hear it said, you know, to forgive means that we forget the offense ever happened. You know, I'm going to forgive and I have to forget that it ever happened. And people struggle with that. But listen, let's make it very clear. Forgiveness and forgetting are two separate things altogether. And there's the reality of it. Sometimes the pain of an offense is going to radiate and not go away that easily. And even if a person wants to forget, the pain is so present, there's no way that they're going to be able to forget what took place in that. We can't make our minds forget something. It's not like the recycle bin on the computer where you're just making it go away. Our brains, our minds, our emotions don't even work like that. Forgetting is a different thing. We'll talk about forgiveness, but forgiveness and forgetting are separate things. Forgetting has to do with healing. And that's something that's in God's venue. That's something that God is working in our lives and in our hearts. And that has a lot more to do with coping, being able to cope with who we are, where we are, and who's in control, who's in charge in our lives. The other thing that we get confused about is that we think that forgiveness is an emotional state. And we'll even say things, I don't feel it in my heart to forgive. And we're expecting some sort of rush of emotion that goes along with forgiveness, and that's not the case. No, forgiveness is an act of the will. It's a decision that we make regardless of how we feel in the situation. I choose to forgive. I've told Ruth Peterson's story way too many times. You're probably sick of hearing it, but that was the case in her when she was terribly wronged by a first husband. She got to the place where she was realizing she had to forgive and pray for her ex-husband and his new wife. And she started down that path. Lord, I pray you bless them, but I don't really mean it. And she was honest and sincere, but she kept moving in that direction. It wasn't an emotion that she was waiting to feel. It was an obedience. And that's what forgiveness is all about in our lives. We choose to forgive. But listen, even though we're choosing to forgive, even like in Ruth's story, it's a process. It's not going to happen overnight. We don't just say, okay, I forgive and boop, it's all taken care of. Our hearts don't follow commands like apps on our phone. We don't command our heart like we talk to Siri. Heart, forgive that person. Okay, I'll look into that. Or something like that. Forgiveness is an act of the will, but it's a process that we go through at the same time. It's a journey we set out on. And our ability to walk in that forgiveness is going to have ups and downs as we go. There's going to be times when we're feeling victorious and secure in our ability to put that aside and forgive that individual. And there's going to be other times when we're just wrestling with ghosts all night long. But what's important is our determined, continuous path. Eugene Peterson words it, the long obedience in the same direction. That's why we're describing this as a willingness to forgive, a determination. This is the direction I'll go in this. Sometimes we confuse forgiveness and reconciliation. That, you know, I've forgiven, that means that we're going to reconcile. But again, forgiveness and reconciliation, like forgiveness and forgetting, are separate issues. Those are separate things in this. Obviously, reconciliation is a goal that we want to have. I mean, reconciliation, that's the theme of the gospel. Man being reconciled with God, and then are reconciled between our fellow human beings. You know, peace on earth, goodwill towards men. But reconciliation, whenever we think in terms of reconciliation, we have to understand that that is something that is going to move us forward into a better future, into a better relationship, into a better standing with each other. Reconciliation, if it's something that's just going to loop us back and drop us back into the way things used to be, let's get back to how things were, that is not reconciliation based on what the Bible intends for us. Reconciliation from a biblical perspective is moving us forward into a better, healed state with one another. If we're looking at trying to, you know, get back to the way things were, that's kind of like trying to fix the past. And we can never fix the past. We can only move forward into healing and new life. And sometimes, you know, because things haven't changed, and, you know, even outside, well, we know it's true within community, but even like in the smaller microcosms of our individual relationships, if change hasn't occurred along the way, sometimes reconciliation isn't a good thing. It may not be advisable at all in some cases. Say somebody's in an abusive relationship and there's no signs of that abuse stopping other than just ongoing apologies. Oh, I'm so sorry, da, 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 da. Reconciliation in that case would be unhealthy. That would be the wrong choice to make. It would be dangerous for the person who's being abused. And look, Jesus just got finished saying there may come a point in time when we're going to have to part company. We're going to go separate ways. It's a recognition that remaining in the situation isn't healthy for anybody, but that has nothing to do with forgiveness. You see what we're saying in that? There's separate things. Forgiveness occurs in our hearts and in our attitudes towards someone else. And it doesn't automatically imply that everything's going to go back together the way it was. So what is forgiveness then? I mean, so what is it? The simplest answer to give on that is that of letting go. It's first finding our wholeness and our healing and our stability in God's love for us, and then letting go of our desire for retribution or revenge or repayment, and trusting that God will do what's best in that whole situation. In Revelation, when the souls under the altar are crying out to Jesus saying, when are you going to avenge what happened to us? Jesus responds saying, vengeance is mine. I'm in charge of repayments, is what he's saying in that. Because he's the only qualified judge who can deal with things fairly and truly and with perfect mercy. He's the only one qualified to do that. Forgiveness, then, is a willingness to let the thing go. To be able to say, maybe even say to the person, you don't owe me. You don't owe me anything. I release this to my Savior. There's nothing you need to do. There's nothing you need to pay. Because God is my healer and He makes me whole. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. You don't owe me a thing. And see, here's the big thing in all of that. Forgiveness is about our healing. You realize that. Again, another mistake that we sometimes make in our thinking on this. It's not really about the other person as much. You know, we think that by withholding forgiveness, we're making sure they understand the severity of their crime. Oh, I will never forgive you, and I hope you'll take that. And we don't even realize that it's not even true at all. We're the ones who suffer for our own unforgiveness. We're the ones who are caught in that. As long as we withhold forgiveness from the other person, that person still owns us. And that offense still defines us emotionally, keeps us chained to the pain of it all. To let it go is to find our own escape in this. To forgive is to find our own freedom. In fact, that's what Jesus explains in this odd little parable that he tells to make his point. Verse 23. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. When he began to settle, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Since he couldn't pay, his master ordered him to be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and payment to be made. So the servant fell on his knees, imploring him, "Have patience with me, and I'll pay you everything." And out of pity for him, the master of that servant released him and forgave him the debt. But when that same servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. And seizing him, he began to choke him, saying, "Pay what you owe." So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, "Have patience with me, and I will pay you." But he refused and went and put him in prison until he should pay the debt. When his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their master all that had taken place. Then the master summoned him and said, "You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me, and shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had on you?" And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailers that he should pay all his debt. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you don't forgive your brother or sister from the heart. Okay. I'm going to say that the details of this story, and I listen to you, this is very important. The details of this story worked better with an Eastern audience than it does with a Western audience like us listening to it. And we have to remember, parables are things that we don't want to sift through the details and try to make exact correlations on every little detail between heaven and earth, etc. What we want to do is stick with the themes that are represented in this story. So we've got a servant who somehow found himself indebted to his superior to the amount of 10,000 talents. That is an extreme number. This is clearly hyperbole, because the combined annual tax payments of Galilee and Perea that were paid to Herod at that time only came to 200 talents. He's talking about 10,000 talents here. Some have suggested that 10,000 talents was actually more money that was in circulation in Palestine at that time. So we've got this exaggerated sum, and the theme is pretty straightforward. A guy is forgiven this incalculable sum of money, but when he comes across a peer who owes him next to nothing in comparison, he refuses to extend forgiveness to him. And it results in being a problematic situation for the one who refuses to forgive. So the irony carries a warning and an instruction about our motive to extend forgiveness, and that is our willingness to forgive. It is an extension of the freedom that we have found in God. It's an extension of the freedom of forgiveness that we found. God has forgiven us and set us free which enables us to set others free and let these things go. Now, all too often, probably because of the way this parable ends, this gets presented almost as a threat, you know, because it almost kind of reads like one, really, actually. I mean, that's why I think there's a disconnect for us as Westerners trying to read this. But sometimes this will be presented as, see, you better forgive or you won't be able to get to heaven. And I don't know if you've heard it that way. I certainly have in my experiences before. But is that what Jesus is really trying to say in this? And that's what we've got to puzzle through. I mean, putting all things together and understanding this piece with the rest of the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament. Is he really telling us that there is something that we have to do, some work that we have to achieve in order to be saved? That's a hard one to try to figure out. Not to mention the fact that if this is a threat, it sort of undermines the whole previous point about 70 times 7. Because that would be sort of like Jesus saying, you know, forgive 70 times 7, but that's for you. You cross me twice and you're out. I mean, that's it. You know, it's kind of the way that would look if this is a threat. So I want to say that we need to keep in mind that this is a parable, so it needs to be understood in the world of parabolic and hyperbolic exaggeration, you know, metaphor and things that are exaggerated. I mean, come on, nobody does this well. Nobody does what he's commanding here well. No one lives according to Jesus' 70 times 7 to forgiveness perfectly, which means that if we're going to read this parable literally, that is, make forgiveness into a law, we are all doomed. I don't know how any of us get through this unscathed at that point. But what if we read the judgment of the king another way? What if we imagine that rather than forecasting a future punishment for this unforgiving servant, Jesus is actually describing the present condition of that unforgiving person, the present condition that he already lives in. That is, a person already a slave to the world of counting and calculating, of reckoning an eye for an eye in life. Unforgiveness is already a jailer, and he's going to remain in that prison. God won't force him to forgive someone, so he remains captive in that jail of an offense that he refuses to let go of an offense that he's not willing to release. There's no freedom. We could say then that's the theme of this, because the threat of slavery at the outset and the imprisonment at the end of it, the idea is there is no freedom in life without forgiveness. There's no freedom for any individual without that willingness to forgive. God's purpose in our lives is to restore us back to original intent, to humanize us, to set us free from the bondage of the broken patterns of this world. And he does that first by extending the freedom of forgiveness to us. Despite all that we've done, despite of all our mistakes and our failures in lives, intentional, unintentional, he forgives without boundary. And then he invites us into his world of freedom that's found in that forgiveness. He invites us into that same state. And he forms us into this community that celebrates and then embodies this freedom of forgiveness in the way that we interact with each other, in our treatment and our attitude towards each other. And I believe that's the point that he's making in this. That the freedom that we're looking for in community is only going to be found in that willingness to extend the same kind of grace and love that's been extended to us by God. And a community like that does not come easy. It just doesn't. It's hard work. And conflicts are bound to happen, and we're tasked with navigating through the troubles that occur because of that. But we can do it, because God's empowered us by forgiving us and showing us the way to freedom. Community like this that we're describing takes effort, but it's so worth it because this is where Christ is present. We're able to, when we're able to put these things into practice, we're able to catch a glimpse of what it looks like when heaven rules earth. We get a glimpse of what life can be in God's healing rule. So let's follow Christ's teachings as it comes to how we pursue community. Let's be an honest and a personal and a forgiving community. And by that, maybe we can let the world know that the kingdom of heaven is closing in. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, please? God, we're grateful to you for what we learn from your word. And I just pray, Lord, that our hearts are tuned to your spirit and that you guide us into this kind of community. Preserve this community and bless this church that gathers in your name. And we trust you to do that in Jesus' name.